once again with the one,
the only,
Brian Francis Slattery, who is most recently the author of Lost Everything. Brian, how are you doing? It's a pleasure to have you back here on our program.
It's good to be back here. And thanks for letting me eat and drink while I'm talking to you.
Yes, it's one of the very rare programs that allows authors to and eat. Most programs allow authors to starve for an hour. And they sometimes, anyway, we don't do that here. Well, first of all, how are you doing? I didn't quite get that question answered. You're doing okay?
How am I doing? Oh, yeah. I'm great. I'm good.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then let's get down to business. For some inexplicable reason, and I have no idea why, maybe you might have a few ideas, but since roughly around 2008, again, I have no idea why, there's been a great rush of dystopian novels, doom and gloom, and here we have number three from you, sir. So, just to start off here, I mean, I'm wondering, when you started writing Lost Everything, were you aware of what might be called a glut or what might be called a overpopulated field of dystopian novels? And, you know, do you care about such a output that's going on simultaneously as you're working on a book?
I guess I just say I was mildly aware, but not that aware. It's not something I pay that much attention to, I guess. You know, even in stuff that I read a ton of nonfiction.
Sure.
So I'm sort of vaguely aware of trends in fiction, but they have to be pretty big for me to be aware of them, I'm afraid. But yeah, it's not something that I think about that much. You know, it's not the idea of like chasing a trend or worrying about a trend. You just have to sort of, at least for me, like I just kind of worry about whether I can write a good book or not.
Yeah.
You know, and then see where it turns out. And in the, you know, and in the case of the third one, it was like, you know, that from the first to the third one, one sort of grew pretty naturally out of the other. There were some, you know, questions that I'd liked in the first one that I never got around to that I did some of in the second one, and then there was still some left over. So there's another book. But
well, such as
now
what
that's kind of it. You
what
know,
specific questions are we talking about here?
Gosh, let me think. I think like the best, from the second to the third one, probably the best thing was, you know, the reception to it was really great. I mean, it was really, really gratifying. One of the things that I ended up sort of taking to heart, though, was, you know, there were people who were accusing me of being sort of too flippant, you know, and I thought, well,
really?
That's fair. That's
you
fair.
Took that to heart?
I did.
Does this explain why this one is just really very bleak at times?
Yeah,
I mean, I was
it
like,
is.
Wait,
no,
I mean,
it
it's
is.
Not to say it's
it
devoid
is.
Of humor because you do have the music.
No, but it is.
Yeah.
It's quite a bit darker. And for a while, I actually, you know, I got halfway through it and I thought, God, this book is really dark. And then, you know, I thought, well, at least I should finish it. And then I finished it and I thought, no, it's still really dark. And there was a part of me that you know, because I'm not really that serious a person, and I was really kind of surprised that I'd written such a serious book. But it also seemed like, you know, there's a point where I, you know, for the first two books, I think that there was a real conscious effort to make sure the stakes weren't so high that you couldn't joke about it. And then, you know, eventually the stakes are high enough that it seemed kind of creepy to joke about it.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, you know, nobody would be joking in this kind of situation. Nobody would be just kind of horsing around. There's no place for it anymore. And so like, you know, I tried to find the humor where I could get it, but it felt increasingly forced to go for it. And it also seemed like kind of a fair trade to trade. I felt like I was trading sarcastic for creepy. And I'm sort of okay with that.
You are.
You know.
I mean,
like,
well,
I think
well,
if it was...
What do you define as sarcasm? I mean, you know,
yeah.
Having joy and having fun...
Yeah.
Against an especially bleak or depressing environment, to my mind, isn't sarcasm. And I don't think it has been really sarcasm in either Liberation or Spaceman Blues. I think it was sort of a sense of irony. So how do you distinguish between irony and sarcasm here? I mean, and I'm really curious about the fact that you
that's a good
decided
that's
to
a
like...
Fun, that's a fun question to ask me, actually. Because
well,
I consider myself to be a pretty sarcastic person, but also kind of anti-irony.
Yeah, yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think that what it comes down to is that, like, I don't... The way that I just... I mean, this is obviously sort of like the pop culture version of irony. You know, it's not the, like, the... lit crit version of it. But, like, you know, the pop culture version of it is that, like, at the end, the joke is over, and you're not really sure what the person's intentions are. Like, yeah. The person has done a lot to kind of hide what they actually think, and I don't try to do that, you know? So, like, no, this looks great. Thanks. So,
Did you want to pause? You could actually eat that?
No, it's fine.
Oh, it's fine. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So the, like, you know, I try to sort of joke around, but I try to be kind of honest about it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And to, like, not be really ambiguous about what it is that I'm trying to say, you know.
But, well, in terms of distinguishing between lit crit irony and pop culture.
So much. Are you recording?
Yes.
Oh, because I'm going to use the hammer for a few. Do you have for a long time?
It's probably like 30, 40 minutes or something like that.
Okay. Do you mind? I just have for 5 minutes. I will tell you when
Okay, why don't you know? We can stop. Wait, okay, we'll stop. 5 minutes. Okay. Okay, so back in action here. So we were talking about irony and sarcasm and humor and the differences between pop culture irony and lit crit irony. And then two gentlemen decided to start construction on us, and they've stopped, thankfully. They were very nice.
And it looks really good.
Yes, it does look really good. So we were trying to peg what you view your humor to be.
Right.
And I insisted that it was actually working in some quasi-ironic mode.
Nice of you.
A sincere irony, I suppose. Or like, I suppose, the joys of contradiction. And you were saying, no, Ed. Actually...
No, we're probably talking about the same thing.
Yeah, we're probably talking about the same thing.
Well, question of which word you like.
Let's turn the arc light to the author here on this. And you were feeling that you were doing too much of this. So... this explains, in part, the bleakness of Lost Everything.
Well, I guess the other part that sort of explains the bleakness is, like, you know, in the second book, when you took, like, the idea of, like, a really serious economic collapse. I mean, it's really serious, but, you know, places recover from that. Yeah, there's a way that I think you can afford to be a little bit. Hope you can be, like, much more obviously hopeful about it, because there really is a chance for everything to, like, be rebuilt.
Yes.
Yeah, that happens.
You
that
wanted
has
no
happened
chance.
A lot. Well, I didn't want no chance. It was more like, you know, I guess I wanted to write this book about climate change. And then the more you think about it, the more you're just like, oh my God, like, what are we gonna do?
Yeah.
What are we gonna do? And, like, there, you know, we don't know what, I mean, this is the way that I don't, this is the way that I don't think it's as bleak as it initially appears, which is that you just don't know what's going to happen, you know, and, like, it looks bad, but who knows? And, like, there's obviously some hope in the who knows part, or it's there if you choose to find it. And I think that, like, what's been interesting about the response to this book so far, I think, is that, like, people seem to be pretty polarized about that.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's just unrelentingly bleak or actually pretty optimistic. And, like, I kind of see it both ways. Ha ha. I mean, I know it's kind of a cheap way to get out of that question. But, like, I don't think it's unrelentingly bleak. And
yeah.
I was, even though I was really worried about that every sentence that I was writing it, you know, when I read it, I mean, I find the book to be quite sad, but I don't find it to be, like, a reason to slit your wrists in the bathtub or anything.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
going from this idea of economic collapse, where there is some possibility of restoration, to Lost Everything, which presents, no, you've actually got to wrestle with the fact that there is this strange unknown storm called the Big One, which we don't even know, we really don't know much about, aside from the fact that it's pretty evil and it turns people fairly hopeless and it basically gives people no reason to live. You know, the fascinating thing here,
obvious reason. They have to come up with one.
Well, you have to come up with one.
Then they have to make it.
Yeah. But I mean, this is interesting because it's almost as if you wanted to squanch away. Well, squanch is not a word. You wanted to squelch.
But yet I understand what you meant.
Yes, exactly.
You just stick with
I think
squanch.
What happened is that squelch and staunch came together, and it became squanch.
And 100 years from now, it's going to be in the OED.
Yes, exactly. And yeah. We started it right here. This is the moment. This is the moment. The footnote. Brian Francis Slattery in conversation.
Anyway. Oh, there you go.
So, the point I wanted to make was, rather long-windedly, it's actually not much of a point, but I wanted to ask you about, did you really want to examine this idea of finding hope when there was no possibility for construction? Was the idea here to narrow the walls so impossibly, and speaking of physical space, I'll get into that later, but so that you have to actually make a choice. Either the characters have to make a choice through this wandering narrator who sometimes takes on the spirit of the characters, or the reader decides, well, is there hope here or is there not?
That's actually exactly right. Like, there was kind of a lot of... Well, okay, this actually starts with my... I felt like I used up my quota of semicolons.
I didn't realize you got one.
So there are a ton of semicolons in both of the first two books.
Yes, I know. So yeah, that is true, though.
I thought, well, I'm gonna do this without any semicolons. There's gonna be, and like, but the semicolon is your ultimate hedge, right? You can write your first part of your sentence and say something strong, add a semicolon, and then completely contradict yourself in the second part of the sentence, and everybody thinks that's fine, right? So like when I got rid of the semicolons, finally you're like, all right, I really just have to say things. Yeah. I have to say them and mean them.
Yeah.
And
but there's a loophole because you could always start a sentence with a verb, as you do many times in this.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a little bit of a loophole there,
yeah,
Brian.
I mean, a little bit, but I really did feel like, all right, you know, now I just really kind of have to say things. And I think that a lot of it kind of came, you know, a lot of it sort of grew out of the voice of the narrator, that there was something for me. It was fun to set up something that was kind of hard to do, you know, where there was no way to get out, and I just had to get through it. And I think part of the reason why that seemed like a good idea is because one of the sort of questions that came up in the first book, but I dodged completely in the second one, was like, that, you know, I realized that I was kind of, you know, nudging toward these ideas about faith and spirituality that I was really afraid of doing, because I myself am completely agnostic.
Yeah.
You know, I was raised Catholic, but I think this is a quote that I got from a friend who says it's from Christopher Reeve, of all people. It's a good quote that says, like, I'm not sure if there's a God, but I try to pretend like he's watching. I try to act like he's watching. And like, I sort of put myself in that category. But, you know, I myself am totally agnostic, but I have a, what seems to be a sort of, at least these days, an unusual sympathy for people with a great deal of faith. You know, there's, and a lot of admiration. And I think that part of that came from seeing the response of, I mean, the example that immediately comes to mind is things like, you know, like when Hurricane Katrina came in and like destroyed New Orleans. You know, the government was sitting back and saying, oh, there's nothing we can do. And a lot of people across the country were saying, oh, this is horrible. There's nothing, you know, why isn't there anything we can do? And then meanwhile, like, a bunch of church groups in the South got in a bunch of buses and drove down there and handed out blankets and handed out food. And you go, like, that's amazing. And they did that because they felt like they had to. You know, they felt like this is their faith in action.
Yeah.
And, like, I really admire that impulse. And you see it in a lot of places. And I thought that it would be really neat to actually write a book where there are people who do that. You know, people who are, like, wrestling with serious questions about faith.
Sure.
And trying to put them into action and trying to, like, they're willing to take on some very difficult questions that, like, the rest of, you know, the rest of us agnostics and non-faithful people get to completely dodge, you know, for our entire lives. But I was really, you know, I was really interested in that set of questions, and it was... And those two things kind of dovetailed, you know, the situation that I created and my desire to write about that came together very nicely, at least in my brain they did. And
yes.
Then I happened to have a very good friend who is an Episcopal priest, and he helped me a lot in, you know, in sorting out not just how I felt about it, but how somebody with a great deal of faith would also feel about it and think about it. And, you know, turned me on to a lot of really great writers, you know, who are, I mean, the guy that really stands out is a guy who's, he's in the Divinity School and the Philosophy School, I think, at Yale, whose name is Nicholas Waltersdorf, who's one of, like, my favorite writers now. Really, like, brilliant, brilliant guy who, like, heads straight into some really tough questions and is able to, it's not an answer because I think that he's too smart and too humble maybe to come down on one side or another, but the way that he wrestles with them is like astonishingly compact. And it's
what's a typical sort of philosophical dilemma that he offered that you were able to possibly apply to?
I mean, the biggest one that he provided a really good answer to, but there's a lot of people that wrote about it, was the whole question of, like, you know, if you take Christianity pretty seriously, you end up in a pretty sort of apolitical and rather pacifist place, and that makes it a pretty tough place to be when the things that are happening around you don't call for pacifism. You know, my friend, whose name is Drew Bunting. So, you know, Drew had pointed out, you know, in World War II, there are a bunch of priests that have to decide in Germany how they feel about the Nazis.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, because there is a way that, like, you know, one part of the teaching calls for you to be, like, it's all about forgiveness and understanding and, you know, and showing mercy. And then the other part of it is about righteousness, you know, and you say, well, these people are doing horrible things, and isn't there something I should be doing here? And, like, for people who take those questions seriously, it's a really big deal. And it takes a lot of, I think that they have to wrestle with that in a way that, you know, it's a little more, it's not quite as acute if you don't have the trappings of faith. But on the other hand, those trappings of faith give you a strength to deal with the questions, I think.
But can't one broach,
you know,
the question
that's
out?
Really it. Then all of that is very interesting to me.
Yeah, but can't one broach these moral questions outside of faith?
Sure.
I certainly do.
Sure.
You know,
no, absolutely.
I mean, you know, then you get into a pickle because all of a sudden, well, if I'm basically creating the moral code and if it's some mishmash from, you know, either philosophy or religion,
right,
maybe in some sense I am subscribing to this agnosticism as well, you know.
No, sure, sure. I mean, for me, that was the easier part of the book to write.
Yes.
You know, it's like, because, I mean, part of the reason that there are two characters is that, you know, one of the characters is quite agnostic.
Yeah.
And the other one is quite faithful. And what was fun for me is to having those two characters talk about it and have one of them be talking about it in secular terms and the other one be talking about it in religious terms.
Yeah.
And to, like, look for the ways that those two arguments could dovetail.
Yes.
You know, because I think part of it, we hear a lot about how the secular and the religious world in America are completely divided.
Yeah.
And I don't think that that's actually true.
Yeah.
You know, like,
well,
I think we have to live with each other,
right?
Exactly. I think, like, in people's day-to-day existences, they don't sit there and say, like, oh, that person goes to church, I can't be friends with them. Like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, and it was more interesting to put these two people together who saw the same situation in very different ways, but that they not only, their understandings helped each other, you know, and helped each other get through this pretty tough place that they're in. You know, and, like, that sort of thing got really interesting to me.
Well, what's interesting also is there are a number of differing ambiguities within this book. I had mentioned one before with the big one. We don't know the exact nature of this storm.
Mm-hmm.
There's another one that's more interesting, that there's perhaps more comfort to perhaps a reader, such as myself, I suppose, who is actually interested in answers against the limit, and that is, I would say, the physical dimensions inside the Carthage, this boat.
yeah.
You know, I'll be point blank, Brian. You know, I mean, to some degree, part of me was a little pissed off about the big one, because I actually was curious to know more about it. But on the other hand, eventually, near the end, I began to just accept it. But
right.
I did feel this tension of wanting to know, especially when,
like,
I felt,
why the heck is that?
Yeah,
there?
Yeah. It's like, oh, yes, that bastard. He's not. He's and I'm like, okay, He's not going to give me the answer. I understand now he's not going to do that.
Well, the reason for that is pretty, you know, and the reason for that is that you, like, if the book is about faith, you can't give the answer.
Sure.
The whole point is that, like, you believe in something without knowing.
But here's the thing. The Carthage, I found this to be absolutely my level of what I like, because, you know, you give us enough of an idea of what's it like to be inside that thing, but at the same time, there could be all sorts of secret rooms in here that we don't know about. It's so massive and so huge. It has a library. It has that place where they're playing Russian roulette. Mm-hmm. It has that place where, you know, the con artist is getting his rocks off. You know, it's like, it's got a little place for everything, and yet one doesn't need to know the full expanse because one has some identifying human markers.
That is actually pretty interesting,
markers.
Isn't it?
And so, yeah, exactly. And so, I'm like,
people.
Brian's right on the money with this. The Carthage I can get behind, but that bastard is not giving me anything for the big one. But you did test me, and you did test me, to your credit, and right around page 200, I'm like, okay, I accept the big one. I accept that it's just, I'll never know more about that. And just to turn this back to you, I mean, you know, is this the level of ambiguity that just delighted you in writing this book, that you want to really just fuck with a reader, like, fuck with people like me? Or did this come from the these issues of faith that we're talking about too? Did the limitations, the,
yeah,
and
it's
also
really
the competing,
it's really more the second one. Like, like there's a, like, both of the the first two books I wrote have omniscient narrators.
Sure.
Like, they're super omniscient. They're ridiculously omniscient. And this was the first thing I'd maybe ever done where the narrator wasn't.
Yeah.
You know, and I got really interested in playing with that, you know, and like, and actually kind of like severely limiting how much he could possibly know. Like, he's like a, you know, it's, you know, to some extent he's sort of like a little plot device, right? But, you know, he's also like a real guy, you know, who actually had to piece together the story himself, like an investigative reporter.
Yeah.
And you think, it got me thinking really hard about, like, well, all right, you know, there's certain things he's not going to know. He's just, you know, he's not, like, he's finishing this before the storm is over.
Sure.
So, like, he doesn't know where it comes from. He's not going to meet anybody who does. You know, he doesn't, because, like, that's not the way that this world is working.
Sure.
Like, there's not a lot of information around, and he's trying to piece together what he has with the very little that he knows. And, like, that got to be a really, for me, it was occasionally a very frustrating limitation. But it was also really fun to, fun is, I've used the word fun a lot, but really the reality of, like, when I was writing it, it didn't feel like work exactly, but it wasn't blissful fun either. But it was really interesting and satisfying would probably be the right word, you know, to try to limit what I could do and then see if I could actually make a book work even under those kind of constraints.
Yeah. So the delight came almost in having a narrator matching the character predicaments, where the narrator, as much as the characters are trying to come up with, is trying to come up with some identity from the scraps of the world that is left.
Yeah.
And to mimic that, it gave you both, what I'm getting here, both a great delight and a great sense of frustration.
Yeah. I mean, but it's really like, delight. Anyway.
Delight. Well, fun was the word you were using earlier.
It's more the, exactly. Yeah. I don't know why I always kept using that word. But the,
well, let's get the noun right here.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, because like I said, I mean, the subject matter, parts of the book were sort of difficult to write in the sense that I, like, you know, you find yourself, like, looking up, you know, when you create the world like this, it's based on, a lot of it is based on things that have actually happened in the real world.
Yeah.
And, you know, those things are deeply unpleasant and really upsetting. And that's the, you know, that's the reason I'm sort of resisting the word fun, because I don't want to use the word fun to describe learning things about, like, the second war in the Congo.
Yeah.
that's not, you know, it's inappropriate.
Yeah.
But it was satisfying to sort of try to do justice to a lot of those ideas.
Yeah. On the other hand, I will say that, I mean, maybe you can, now that I have you here, there, the two moments, the Russian roulette scene, where the guy basically blows his brain out and he has you know, there's no sense of whether he did this deliberately or he was just like, just a casual blowing his brains out. Mm-hmm. And you describe the many scraps of skull that are on the ground. And then there's also the very grisly Ferris wheel situation where you have this body that can't be found. I mean, it's almost like, you know, something out of like Eastern Europe or something, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, so it's that kind of level of bleak humor. So, I mean, was something like that, I guess, fun in the way that we are describing, or did that come as a way of wrestling with something you discovered that actually happened?
I think a lot of it came out of, you know, reading things about people who have survived really difficult things like that. And they do find humor in it. You know, like it's a wonderful defense mechanism and a wonderful way of preserving your sanity when it's over.
Yeah.
Right? Is to you know, to be able to make some joke about it. Even though it's not going to be funny to anyone. You know, it's like it's a good thing for you, because otherwise this is the milder way of putting it is I worked at one point at a place that did that funded social science research into violence around the world. And, you know, there's a group of people who are genocide scholars. You know, that's what they do. They study genocide. They study individual episodes of genocide. They study genocide as a phenomenon, you know, across history. And you meet a couple of them, and, you know, it seemed that they fell pretty sharply into two groups. You know, there were the people who sort of, you know, it seems like at some point you hit a point where you either laugh because it's just too much, or it just kind of takes you over and you become a very serious person, you know, all the time.
Yeah, that's clearly not you right now.
Yeah, I mean, like I do remember a point like at that job where I did feel like, well, I either have to start laughing or I have to, you know, or I have to sort of just succumb to the whole thing and get extremely serious. And like, I don't think it's a question of whether you take the subject seriously. It's more about how do you like get through the rest of your day.
Yeah.
You know, when you're, or it's like, you know, you think about people who are like, you know, human rights monitors, or I'm sure like emergency workers, you know, people who have these really difficult jobs, and they, you know, at some point they have to like figure out how to go to the grocery store afterwards. You know, and that's the like, you know,
it's the thing we don't want to talk about life in any country,
yeah,
or
yeah,
in any socioeconomic,
like,
status.
You can't let it completely overwhelm your life. I mean, you have your shoes to tie and your keys to, you know, and your car needs to go to the shop and all that kind of stuff. You know, but like that I think that like I thought about that a lot when I was writing the book, because it occurred to me that like each character was going to have that sort of moment where they have to decide like how much they, I mean, this is one way to put it, is like how much their own life is worth, you know, and like how they sort of feel about that. And, you know, one thing that came out of, like, I talked to somebody who had grown up in Ukraine and came here in like 1994, and he said something that was really interesting. You know, he goes, because, you know, we were sort of comparing notes of like things I had seen in like Guatemala and in Africa, and things he had seen growing up. And the way that he put it was really neat. I mean, he just said, like, don't you get the feeling that just in some parts of the world, like, life is just cheaper? Like, people do things that are kind of dangerous without thinking about it that much. You know, they'll drive really fast, like way faster than anybody here would drive. You know, they'll climb up on something to like fix their drainage pipe, and it's like, you know, five stories up, and they'll just kind of go up there and do it.
Yeah.
You know, without any kind of regard for their own safety.
Yeah.
You know, and like part of it has to do with just where they are. Like it is a little cheaper. You know, and like that has a way of affecting people, and it has a way of affecting the way that they act and the things that they do.
But in using a word like cheaper, you immediately ascribe a quality to that life, and maybe it's not cheaper, maybe it's actually fuller.
That's right.
I mean, when we think, you know, you're a parent,
right.
I mean, when we think of all, I was talking about this to someone last night, the world that we grew up in America is inconceivable to live that way when you're dealing with the pressures that are put upon kids to be in school,
right.
The endless warnings in playgrounds, the the constant judgment of other parents for things that are really trifling and really none of their business. Hey, your kid did this, or, you know, questions of nutrition, like you're going to permanently damage the kid if he has
if he has
you had sausage just
exactly. He has a popsicle.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yes. Something like that.
Food coloring.
Sugar as a disruptive force, which
different.
Here's one great.
It's a totally different attitude. Totally different.
I was actually in a restaurant with some friends, and I actually got reprimanded because I was just having a very pleasant conversation, and I said, "Hey, fuck yeah!" And then like some guy pulled me aside and gave me a look. I'm like, "What?" And it just never occurred. I mean, I wasn't saying it in any sort of like profane. I mean, it wasn't profane to me.
No.
And chances are the kids are going to be fine. But he looked at me as if I had like went ahead and tried to proposition his kid or something. This is the kind of thing I'm talking about. I mean, I got off on a huge tangent here, but to steer this into judgment, I mean, was this of interest to you in writing Lost Everything or in personally speaking? You're talking about cheaper lives, but is cheaper the right word here?
Well, it's the word that the guy I was talking used. Well, I think obviously cheaper isn't the right word in that one of the things that I think, so at one point when I was really worried that this book was just like way, way too bleak, I went out and read some really bleak books because I wanted to sort of compare. It's like, well, how bleak is this really?
That explains everything.
No, and it was more like I was just worried. I was like, have I just written this thing that's so beyond the pale that like I don't want to read it, you know? But like, you know, I read a few things that were like really quite something. And like, I realized one thing that differentiated this book from those was that like I don't think that life is cheap, you know. It's like I have this like I have this like compulsion almost just to find like the value in everyone, you know. You go like look at this guy like, and like, you know, I think like to the extent when people don't find the book bleak, that's what they concentrate on is like how much, you know, focus there is on like people's humanity. But I think that there's also, you know, the sort of willingness to engage in like the super reckless behavior that some of the things are, you know, some of the people in the book do is kind of, you know, like I think that's like a response to what's going on. You know, they just go like, look, something's going to get me pretty soon, so I might as well do this, I might as well do that, because, you know, whatever. You know, I don't know how much time I have left, and that time is very short. You know, for all of those people, they feel like they might not have more than a few days left. So they're just willing to do things that you wouldn't do otherwise. You know, like that whole sort of like that idea of making like a long-term plan. Well, I shouldn't do that because I'll be in the hospital for 6 months. And you're like, there's no hospital and there's no 6 months. So maybe I will do that. You know,
you mentioned
like the barriers to like doing dangerous things have dropped.
Sure.
That's maybe the best way to put it.
Sure.
You know,
so we're dealing with two points of maxing out on semicolons so you can confront these very issues.
Mm-hmm.
Viewing life, you know, from this sort of seemingly cheaper area, but actually it's full of rich possibilities and full of moral quandaries. The other thing I wanted to talk with you about the fact of the matter is that this world is devoid of electricity.
Mm-hmm.
You are dealing with essentially a late 19th century existence. We see that they're using megaphones instead of microphones. We see that there's a hand-cranked phonograph, but that's pretty much it. This is life as, you know, perhaps it used to be, or, I don't know, perhaps it will be. I'm wondering if this set of limitations helped you with some of these issues we were talking about, and also I was curious
if there's electricity, you just call somebody in Washington.
Of course.
State and be like, hey, you still there?
but I'm also curious, like, the extent of research you did of what it was like to live in the sort of mid to late 19th century in a pre-electricity time. Or did the vantage point of what you were looking at through faith and through other countries, was that enough for you to kind of zero the needle here?
Yeah, it was more about how people live without electricity now.
Yeah.
You know, the that, you know, there are definitely lots of people who live without electricity.
Yeah.
Like, you know, in a lot of places. And, like, that's, that was much more the reference point. You know, the, like, I mean, one of the things that I ended up going back to a couple of times, even though I also found the documentary to be almost unwatchable because it's very depressing, is this thing that, did you see Darwin's Nightmare?
I haven't.
Okay.
So
the guy who did that has made another documentary at one point called Kisangani Diary, where he and some UN workers and his little camera crew, like, take this train out into Congo looking for Hutu refugees who have fled Rwanda, and, like, they find them, and all he does is kind of film them, like, doing their best to make it. Although, you know, this is what makes the documentary basically unwatchable, is that, like, as he announces at the beginning of the movie, he goes, like, by the time you see this movie, most of these people are going to be dead. So, like, he finds them, and then maybe a week later, some armed force also finds them.
Yeah.
And, like, that's that. You know, but then, like, he gets all these, you know, images of the way these people are living, and it's just like, whew. It's very, very, very heavy. Very heavy. But
how
also,
many times did you see this?
Maybe twice or three times. It's not that long a movie. But it, you know, it I think I was, like, halfway through writing this thing when I saw it. And then, you know, and I thought to myself, ooh, right.
It's a good reminder, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, 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 it was. And it was also another part of the, like, you know, yeah, I should really be taking this pretty seriously. You know, because that's basically what all these people are. They're refugees. They have, you know, they've all been fleeing something. And they fled with very little.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's what they are. And it's just like, the refugees in this book have the luck to come across this place that's essentially a sanctuary.
Yeah.
You know, but they still don't have very much. Like, they don't have anything personally, really. It's like whatever they could carry. And that's it.
So lost everything, it sounds to me like this was a maturing point for you as a writer. No, I mean, and I don't say this as a way of, like, well, the 6-year-old Brian is old and gone. No more jokes. No more.
No more jokes.
But you wanted to see. You wanted to really confront, it seems, your feelings about what it is to survive with nothing and find some identity. And
I felt like I'd sort of dodged those questions in the first.
Yes,
two books.
Of course.
That was really. I mean, a lot of it had to do with that. You know, is that you sort of go, all right, you know, I've been literally playing with these ideas for the first two books. And then
now
it's like,
time to own up. Yeah.
Let's just do it.
Yeah.
Let's just do it and be done with it. And I think part of it had to do with, like, the, I sort of realized, like, I kind of wanted to finish this because I didn't want to keep writing like this. I had other things I wanted to do.
And now you've reached that saturation.
Yeah. Yeah, and I sort of figured, well, I'll just do it. You know, I'm gonna try to get to the end of whatever it is. You know, to the best of my abilities, and then call it a day. You know?
So do you feel still at this present time any guilt as a writer for what you don't take seriously? Do you feel that you were able to resolve most of those issues and lost everything? Or?
No, I mean, I didn't want to say it was like the book was driven by guilt or anything.
Yeah, yeah,
it's
or guilt, maybe guilt's the wrong word, but this question of just wanting to take things more seriously. Are there other angles to your writing that you feel that you're not really pushing it to the furthest possible limit of commitment in terms of your commitment, not to the writing, but to just human existence?
That, just that, huh?
Yeah. Or any other ancillary matter.
Yeah, and it was a good way of changing things up. The first two books, you know, like, there's, you know, I have one of those, I'm one of those, like, unfortunate people where, like, the sort of, like, form follows function, form follows function, form follows function. And, like, the, you know, for the first two books, because they were written about who they were written about, and, you know, the voice of the narrator has a certain angle, you know, like the first book was when in doubt for what I was going to, when in doubt for what I was going, like, how this was going to come across, there was a very sort of, what would George Clinton do? And then, like, you know, for the second one, it was kind of more like, a, what would Bob Dylan do?
Yeah.
You know, both of these guys are people who have a lot of fun with what they're doing. And
who was the what will X do for this?
Yeah, like, see, for this one, like, that it was more like a, like, what would, well, part of it was that this is about the place where I grew up. And I wanted to get at some of the things that I thought were both beautiful and best. Both, I've said both, and now I'm going to say like four things. But, you know, beautiful and fascinating and also a little like unsettling about the place where I grew up. And, you know, part of the narrative voice is based on the way some people there talk. You know, they have this very, people will speak in fragments a lot. You know, they don't do complete sentences if they don't have to, you know, and they don't use semicolons. You know, like if you were to write out the things that they say, it would be like declarative sentences all the way.
They'd be alarmed you right now analyzing their speech like this.
yeah, they'd be like, what are you doing? What are you saying? But the, you know, I mean, another thing though is that, you know, and I didn't appreciate this quite as much as I do now that I'm looking at it, is like it's super steeped in like stuff from the 20s. And there's a real, like, for me, there's a real race to the bottom in terms of, you know, your depressiveness factor
yeah.
in 20s music between this guy named Doc Boggs, who is a coal mining Appalachian banjo player, and Skip James, who is, like, this really pretty rough character who played the blues.
Yeah.
And the two of them have this, like, it's like this, it's just an unrelenting, like, There is no hope in their worlds. You know, their musical worlds are just like, you know, things are really rough.
Yeah.
And at the same time, like, they're like, they don't express any hope, but I think that there's a lot of, I think like the fact that they're playing music and the fact that they express themselves the way they do is itself like a form of like resistance
sure.
to it. You know, like they're not lying down and dying. You know, but they're certainly like not, they don't come across as happy people, you know. But they were in some sense like the, you know, they were sort of like my, like, there's a lot of music in all of the books, but like, they were sort of big touchstones for this one, you know, of the like, you like the idea of like, if you're going to float an idea, like, would it pass muster with these two guys
yeah.
as I imagined them? Like, or would they call bullshit? You know, they'd be like, come on.
Well,
you know, so like they were, you know, like to sort of, to the extent that I imagine what their personalities were like by extrapolating from their songs, like they were sort of like my bullshit detector, you know?
That, well, with the musicians though, you have the judge.
Yeah, who's quite happy-go-lucky.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You have the musicians, actually, you need to get them if two characters decide to marry later in the book.
Yeah, right.
The musicians not only offer the, I think, probably best sense of hope and living in this book, but they also have considerable authority, which I find really interesting. you know.
Yeah.
And was a way for this guy.
I didn't think of it that way.
Well,
I know what you're saying.
But it was a very helpful way of saying, okay, I think I see what he's up to. He's suggesting that that the true authority in any community comes from this sort of you know, free-spirited life, even in the face of utter chaos.
Yeah, and I guess, like, you know, it's interesting that you pointed that out. I mean, there's been a long, it's so funny because I was totally, like, not conscious of that when I was writing it. But the, I think for, like, as a musician myself, for a while, you know, I remember coming across, like, a couple of things at a good point in my musical development where it was the idea of music having like a social function, and that I realized that all of the music that I liked was like that. You know, it's like it has a thing that you're supposed to be doing to it. You know, you're supposed to be dancing, or you're supposed to be getting married, or it's like funeral music, or it's something. It's not music for music's sake. It's not art music. It's like, it's really grounded in some like serious social reality. And like, to that extent, like, musicians do have some sort of social authority, right? Like, they're Like, well, they're helping you. Yeah, yeah, right. Like, and like when I started to think of myself that way as a musician, is like doing something for the audience.
Yeah.
Like, there is like a, it, authority's not, you know, it's that, because it's certainly not like tyrannical. You
yeah.
know? But you are sort of, you're obviously giving people some pretty heavy cues regarding how they should be feeling right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's
yeah.
the, like,
not
you should
an
be
author
happy.
Too.
You know? Yeah, they're like, hey, you should be happy right now.
Yeah.
You know, people are getting married. Everybody be happy. You yeah. play something happy, you know. You know, the sad music at the funeral, you know, whatever it is. You know, the or the like, you know, you should be dancing right now. You know, and of course, like, you have to win people over. That's the way it's not authority, is that, you know, you have to be good enough to, like, actually make people dance if you want them to dance. You know, you have to give them what they need. But there's, yeah, I mean, like, when I thought about, you know, the, all the musicians in the book feel that way. And I think that, like, you know, in my head, I pictured them as being like, well, if they're this band on this boat, like, they're not the sort of people that are going to give, they're not going to give them art music. You know, it's not about their personal expression. It's about, like, what they think the people on the boat need. And, like, you know, when I thought about it, I realized it would be this, like, what I would want if I were on that boat is this combination of, like, both sort of, like, serious party music and also, like, enough of the other stuff to be cathartic.
Yeah.
You know, to sort of be like, you know, it's okay to be freaked out right now. Like, that's cool. You should be feeling freaked out. Everybody's freaked out.
Yeah.
Let's acknowledge that. And now let's do some partying. Because that's going to make us all feel a little better. You know?
We should really talk about the house river highway structure. because to my mind, it summoned up all sorts of literary associations. The river, both sort of connoting Mark Twain, especially in the way you have Faisal the pilot reading the river.
Mm-hmm. Totally. That's
straight,
like,
straight out of Life of the Mississippi.
That is totally straight out of Life of the Mississippi. Absolutely.
The highway, of course, you know, there are endless
right.
possibilities.
Take your
Kerouac.
Pick.
Yeah, exactly.
Take your pick. Right.
The home, the house, I mean, well, that is the one constant, both from a physical standpoint and also from a literary standpoint. We've always had homes in America.
Right.
So
that also goes way, way, way back.
Yeah. So you have one of these things steeped in 19th century, another steeped in 20th century. And I'm curious about, you know, first of all, how you devised this interesting triage. Second, you know, how you determined this particular region in America around Pennsylvania and, mm-hmm. and the edge of New York and so forth, and also at the beginnings of Three Mile Island as well.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, what did you do to sort of find the right ideal mode for the continuing
I mean, this is actually a fun editing question, because, like, originally there was no the house, the river.
Yeah.
There was just this long stream of stuff.
Oh, okay.
You know, like, it was all river.
There was no Race for Your Life Charlie Brown moment in this. Sorry.
No, exactly. Yeah, I mean,
I'm the only guy who's going to make that comparison now. Sorry.
We'll see. Yeah. Like, this is just like Race for Your Life Charlie
exactly
Brown.
Exactly Race for Your Life.
Which, you know, which is valid. I think that's a totally valid comparison. So the It is. I mean, this is like, I realized at one point I was reading, this is a total tangent, but at one point I read One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish, and I was just like, both of my books are basically variations on One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish. Like, this is it, you know.
We're getting into really heavy literary discourse here.
This is the blueprint for everything that I've done so far, right here, this book, you know, but anyway, originally there weren't any of those, and, like, this book ended up being really close to this one in a way that I wasn't with the other two. So, like, my own editorial impulses were, like, really not useful. And as I gave it to other people to read, they'd be like, we need something. You know, like, we need more structure here. We need something that's going to, like, help us figure out where we are really quickly. And then, you know, I mean, I obviously, like those three strands were always there, but I was kind of secretly hoping I was going to blend them all together.
Yes.
And then, like, that didn't work out at all. So, you know, I took a step back and went, all right, you know, there's going to be these things are going to be good signposts. But they ended up being really, you know, it was one of those things where as soon as I put them in, I was just like, yeah, I should have done this a long time ago. This makes a lot more sense now. And I think, like, I guess what I was getting at is, like, I'm, you know, it's the, it was cool to just be able to admit that you're kind of, like, the the latest in a really, really, really long line of people.
Yeah.
You know, and to just kind of fess up to all of that, you know, and like, you know, in invoking the archetypes, you get to sort of be like, you know, I can do some Mark Twain and some Joseph Conrad and some Jack Kerouac and some this and some that and some the other thing. And like, you know, the house, like, because like the house thing, you know, at one point I realized that I was also totally ripping off like the Odyssey.
Yeah.
You know, and there's like, that's the whole thing in the Odyssey. There's the house at the end. And sure, you know, right down to like, there's the woman and the child waiting for the guy to show up. I mean, that's...
If you're going
to
rip something off, go for the best, right?
Oh, yeah, totally. Totally. Well, you know, I mean,
you're hardly the first point out.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, and the other thing is, like, I don't have any compunction about ripping off things that other people think are kind of cheesy, too. But the... Yeah.
But how you tell the story that is well-established, that's what makes it different.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, or whatever.
Yeah.
But the you know, I sort of realized, like, all right, like, there's some really sort of, like, fundamental and really old kinds of storytelling going on here. You know, right down to, like, you know, there's a lot, like, a lot of the old English stuff is like that, too, right? Where, like, the house is, like, this bastion against, like, the rest of the world, you know, which is perceived as being a really dangerous place. And it's only when you get inside your house that you're safe,
yes.
You know, that kind of stuff. And I really just wanted to make sure that all of that was evoked. You know, to the greatest extent possible. You know, once I realized how much I needed to do to like let people into what I was trying to do, you know, those labels got really useful.
Sure.
I mean, the reason for the region, I mean, part of it was that like I knew it was kind of going to be about, you know, like, I wanted to do at long last write this book about upstate New York, and I tried to do it for a long time. You know, a long time makes it sound like I'm, like, 70. But for me, a long time. You know, and it always just came out wrong. It was just like, wow, this is bad. This is bad. This is bad. And then I realized that if I sort of, literally approached it, I could actually kind of write about it, finally. You know, and, like, so part of the reason that the story starts south and, like, moves northward is for that. Like, it was a really useful way for me to... like to try to write about the things that I wanted to try to write about. You know, but I think the other part of it is like, I mean, part of it, which is kind of neat, is that like the Susquehanna as a river is unnavigable right now.
Yeah.
You know, it's just too shallow for anything. And it occurred to me like, well, this is kind of neat. Like for all of the stories that we have about rivers, here's this really long river that's like vastly, vastly underrepresented. And it gave me a chance to really write about the area in a way that was pretty fresh, because there's not a lot of stuff out there, and I could sort of describe it as if you've never seen it before.
Sure.
You know, which is really hard to do with other, I mean, so many other rivers have been written about and written about and written about that like they have an image in people's minds even if they've never seen them. But like the Susquehanna River is not like that. Like it's even like sort of literally underutilized.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty amazing how big it is and how sort of not developed it is.
Well, that's one of the charms, I think, of your book and also any book that tackles like, an American region that nobody else is going to write about.
Yeah, I mean, to the point where, you know, like the descriptions of the river itself are like what it is right now.
Sure.
You know, it's like I didn't change, I mean, aside from adding monkeys. but really, like, it, you know, like at one point I convinced two friends to go down like 50 miles of the river with me in a canoe.
Oh, really?
And I just sat there like taking
How
pictures.
How very Bill Volman of you.
Well, the thing is, like, I just didn't know what it looked like.
Yeah.
And I didn't, you know, and I really wanted that level of detail, and I wanted to get like the vibe of the place right. You know, and like.
So you went 50 miles?
We did.
Wow.
Yeah.
How long did that take?
3 days.
3 days.
Yeah. That was really... It was,
that was enough, the 50-mile, 3-day trip?
Well, then after that, like, on a couple of months later, I drove the rest of it.
Oh, I see.
You know, to do the whole thing.
Was there a concern of becoming too familiar with whatever sort of, you know, mossy observations or highway sites, that there might have been too many of those that might have affected your book? Was this a concern of yours? Did you feel that basically one... circuit for both this river and this highway was enough for you to kind of get enough to know it, but certainly not enough to become too obsessive where it actually interferes in the creation of material.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is like I had the luxury of having grown up at the end of
it. Yeah,
you know, so like I didn't feel like, I mean, what I did feel like, and it, as it turned out, it was accurate, was that I was just like, you know, the reason that I had not been able to do anything about it before was that I was just sort of too close to all of it.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'd lived in this place for 18 years, and, you know, I don't know what, you know, you're just too close. You don't know what's important. You don't know what's interesting, all that sort of stuff. And, like, that was a problem when writing the book as well. You know, they're like, I really needed more, much more so than the other two books, I needed people to tell me what was interesting, you know,
sure.
And what, you know, and what was important about it. Cause I had a lot of trouble telling, I just forgot the first part of your question.
That's okay. I think we're sort of,
yeah.
I did actually want to ask you about, Sonny Jim. Now, as you know, I spent 13 happy years in San Francisco, and of course, you know, I took a look at, you know, the city back then, and one of the mayors who you may know is Sonny Jim Rolfe, who also became governor
yeah,
of California.
Yeah, I totally forgot about that.
Yeah,
right.
I'm not sure if he was an influence on Sonny Jim or not. I was just curious from a...
No,
he was
just
actually,
a name that
he was the longest-serving mayor in San Francisco history, and there's actually something really interesting about him, where he, when he was governor, so he died. He died in office... I believe, but he actually, there was basically, he came known as Governor Lynch because a crowd of the population decided to go ahead and lynch these murderers, and he basically said, hey, that's great.
I mean, wow.
You know, and so he became known after that for Governor Lynch, and then he died, and that was it. That was it.
No.
Anyway.
No, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. The names in this book really kind of come out of nowhere. I think.
Oh, really?
There are a couple that are references to things.
Even
like,
Faisal and the Iraq reference there.
Yeah, yeah. That was they were just names that I came up with for the characters. Really, I mean the one that the couple that are references are like the last name of the captain is Mendoza
yeah.
Like to Lydia Mendoza because I really like Lydia Mendoza.
The Mendoza line.
Yeah, yeah, but the. You know, yeah. For the, I mean, the, like Sonny Jim doesn't have. It just seemed. Well, I also kind of liked the idea of calling a character who's obviously pretty. You know, he's a pretty sad guy during the book.
Yeah.
I kind of liked the idea of giving him a name that was kind of happy. You know, just to. I mean, if anything, just to suggest that, like, you know, he might just be able to find a way out of all of this. You know.
Yes. Well, I also wanted to ask you because one last question. We've talked for actually quite a long while. I just so the constant degradation in this book, you know, we see eels coming out of mattresses, the Ferris wheel I had mentioned earlier, the rusting and twisted buildings and so forth. I was curious what you did to balance that and make sure that it didn't become repetitive and make sure that you were doing enough varied decay so that it wouldn't necessarily become like, you know, hey, Brian, shut up already.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, well, you know, people's mileage may vary regarding like how repetitive it is, right? I mean, there are definitely already people that are like, wow, that's really repetitive. I guess like I felt like it was important to put in that level of detail because, I mean, part of it was like, it was there when I went there.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know. It's,
in the present day. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, it was there. And it seemed right to sort of report on it.
Yeah.
You know, to, and it's, you know, it's part of what I wanted to write about too. You know, that like, the, like, as I've gotten older, like, the town where I grew up in is doing really well. But a lot of the places around it are not. And they like they sort of used to be better and they're sort of like every time I visited they sort of like gotten progressively like worse is a very unfair word to use to describe it. But it's more like, you know, there's fewer people there and there's less money.
Yeah.
But they still have all this stuff. And this stuff is getting harder and harder to maintain. And it's like, you know, it adds up to like a certain I think that it add, like the reason that I put it all in there is that I think it adds up to an atmosphere that I think that's how you get. I think when people visit upstate New York and are like a little bit creeped out by it, that's why, is that they see that like everything they see is kind of familiar, but it's also it's like more run down than they're used to. And I think, like, that's unsettling to them.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, that's why you put it in there, is that it's like, you know, hey, there's a stoplight. I know what a stoplight is. Oh, it's not working. Oh, hey, there's the library. Oh, the library's closed. You know, all of that.
Actually,
all of that
books.
Sort of stuff. And, you know, gradually it adds up to, like, wow, this place is hurting.
Yeah.
You know.
Discarded books that are in desuetude are constantly throughout this.
Yeah.
I think there's three moments of, like, books that are dead, and that seemed to be the one that really stuck out, at least, you know, from, like, that's the one thing I think probably that repeats more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess you saw more of that, or does this reflect more of your concern for the future of literature?
Yeah, or it's more like the narrator's concern.
Yeah.
You know, this whole sort of, like, what's the point of writing a book in a circumstance like that? Like, of all the things he could be doing, why is he writing a book? You know? So, like, the narrator's really worried about that, you know, in the way that old English poets were worried about it. You know, there's that sense of, like, well, I'm writing this thing, but, like, why? You know, who's going to read it? You know, why is it important that I be spending time on this? You know, so he was sort of facing these questions that people in America don't usually need to face.
It seems to me that you have considered your time writing these worthwhile, yes?
I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know.
There's some doubt there.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, you never know.
You know, an agnostic position is a great place to end this conversation.
Absolutely.
Ryan, again, a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks, and thanks so much for reading it so carefully.
Yeah.
These are great questions.
All righty. What's it going to do?